Welcome to the Think It Isn't Until It Is podcast. I'm Finn.
I'm Tim.
I'm Guy.
Chapter 7, Spring 2013 to sometime in 2014. If you don't put this track on the record, I Quit is the title of our chapter, in which we write in several different locations, LA, Amsterdam, London, Brighton, and attempt to pull off our second large-scale album. It succeeds, relatively, and we get sent out on tour for the next 5 years, kind of, but it definitely felt like it.
Yeah.
This is the Hard Believer chapter.
Yeah, I'm quite proud of this, actually, because I was thinking at the end of Perfect Darkness, we all sort of had that thing of saying, top that.
Top that.
Right, you've got to go and top. And we kind of did. It's quite exciting that we sort of succeeded in not losing our shit and actually pulling together something that in many ways was, you know, more the same but more so and bigger and different and everything. It's
well, as Guy says in the book at one point, he says after Perfect Darkness, it actually felt like finally we had something to lose.
Yes, you know? That's true. And that's a very good way of putting it.
After Perfect Darkness and everybody kind of going, oh, dude, really good record. Oh, wow. It felt like we'd reached some kind of potential that everyone had been kind of saying, oh, well, you've got potential. And finally, we'd kind of ticked a box, which a lot of people had said, oh, yeah, you've kind of, this is the album we thought you'd make eventually.
Eventually,
you know, four albums later. Yeah. So we kind of, I guess we finished the Perfect Darkness tour, our first bus tour, and felt like proper rock and rollers. And then, we got lots of applause and stuff, and everybody liked the record, and we got some syncs, and we just kind of thought, yeah, an element of, okay, top that. But also, importantly, a kind of element of, okay, it isn't all just a waste of time just to scratch a kind of we're in a band itch. There could be a possible future here if...
There is a there kind of thing.
Yeah, if we can somehow go a bit bigger.
Mm.
So it's like every step on the ladder, you look up a few steps and you go, okay, what do we need to get up a couple more steps? Like, we'd like the bus to be a double decker, and we'd like to do two nights at Parody, so instead of one. And,
yeah,
you know, how do we reach up the bills on the festivals and stuff? And everything had to step up a bit, including the songwriting. Not that it was conscious. We all just write what we write and play what we play.
Yeah.
There's no conscious effort to go, I'm going to write a better record or a different record. But we definitely shared some kind of, we're trying to prove something on Perfect Darkness, which meant that on Hard Believer, I think we kind of approached it with the kind of, okay, people are waiting to hear this, so let's crank up the ambition button and, you know, try and make something, you know, big,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
in a way.
Definitely. And one of the things that we decided quite early on was that we benefited from different locations. So we tended to kind of do different things in different parts of the world. And I know that may sound a bit kind of jet setty and pretentious, but we thought, okay, we do well in America. We do certain things well in America. We do certain things well in, say, Holland, you know, and we do certain things well in the UK. So we decided, I think, quite early on to try and jam and write in all three locations. I definitely remember that being a kind of conscious thing of, let's go to some of our favorite places and do this.
I remember when we did an early songwriting mission, just an exploratory mission for this, and I remember Finn telling me, okay, so we're getting some dates together for this exploratory mission, and we've decided to do it in Amsterdam purely to placate me and keep me happy.
No, really?
And yeah, I remember that's exactly what Finn said. He said, I've chosen Amsterdam, bro, just to make sure that you're in the best spot you can be in, which was really kind and great. And that was when we went to, what was the name of the place? I forget.
Electric Monkey.
That's right.
Yeah, I did a songwriting session there with an artist called Celine Cairo, and just noted it down as like, if we ever want to go and hang and jam somewhere, this would be good.
Yeah.
And I really loved the engineer as well, Casper. He had a really good kind of retro vibe to him. And yeah, it was right. I think we decided that it was money well spent, basically. Mm. It's like, it might seem like a total waste of money to go and spend $2,000 or $3,000 and go stay in a foreign city and hang out in a studio when you can just do it in your own house. But something does happen to you as an artist when you're out of your house and in a studio. All of a sudden you become that studio guy, and it's a different guy. And sometimes that can be a better guy, a more productive guy.
Also the communication, the ability for us to communicate, because when we're all together in Electric Monkey, it's as much a process of elimination as creating things. I remember we did some great work on Shakespeare. T-Bot suggested we put in a very sort of bombastic approach to that chorus, which we hadn't tried, and that ended up being the way we went. But just as much, we eliminated a lot. We know we tried things and realized within 8 bars it's not going to work. Whereas if we're working remotely, I can spend 2 days working on a bass line I think is absolutely brilliant and perfect, email it to both of you guys, and you both turn around and go, no, don't like it, which you could have told me that
in the studio, know,
with 30 seconds together in the studio. And exactly. And so I think there's that too. I think we eliminated possibilities as much as created them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's also important that Hard Believer didn't start in a Brighton loft. It actually started in LA, kind of where the ambition levels for Perfect Darkness were kind of born. Didn't it really? It all kind of began in LA. And there's something about LA which, there's loads of things about LA which royally suck, but that one of the things about LA which doesn't is that, as we mentioned in the Perfect Darkness chapter, you know, Nirvana stayed in the same apartments we stayed in when we recorded Perfect Darkness. And these little nuggets of information just rub off on you.
Yeah.
As well as every view you have, you've seen in a movie that you love at some point, whether it's Walking Down Sunset or recording in a studio where, oh, Frank Sinatra recorded here. And you think, oh my God, you know.
It's got some kind of inspiring kind of history. I remember, because it started with you were living there for a little while, weren't you? You went out to do some songs on a movie soundtrack.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly where the first bits and pieces came together, because we'd kind of used up all the bits and pieces that we had doing Perfect Darkness. Mm. There were no more. We've always been a very ethical band. We've recycled every idea we've ever had. So there isn't any, there isn't any like offcuts or like, you know, wastage. So yeah, I got offered a job to write some songs for a movie about a band, and I was set to write the kind of rags to riches montage and a bunch of other songs, which meant that I was writing for someone else, and that led to some really interesting songs which weren't necessarily fully introspective. They were more like, just write the best song you can possibly write at this point. And so I lived in LA, lived in a lovely little house for sort of 3 months, and from those sessions, apart from the soundtrack work, came Shakespeare and Early Looking Too Closely and a few other bangers from Hard Believer. I can't remember which other ones.
Well, I popped out, didn't I, for like a weekend, and we went into King Size, which is again a sort of lovely kind of LA moment, like a inspirational in a different way. So instead of Frank Sinatra, you're thinking, oh great, Elliot Smith was here. You know,
That's right. I mean, King Size was rough and ready, but it had that and it was affordable, most importantly, but it had that really great kind of like, many people have been here. You could feel it as you walked in the door. And
exactly.
And we were also experimenting with session guys, because Perfect Darkness, we had this really great experience through Billy Bush of hiring sessions in to kind of beef up the songs. And they were like, oh, they really made some of the songs on Perfect Darkness like great. So we thought, okay, let's have a jam with a Lap Steel guy. So I was definitely going through a bit of a Laurel Canyon moment, and let's hire a Fender Rhodes guy. And simultaneously, the house that I was renting in LA had a piano in it, so I was kind of tinkling around on the piano a little bit.
Is that where that started?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Jimena had a piano in her house, so I was tinkering around, and I worked with this artist Banks, and she was starting all of her songs with these really cool like little piano riffs. And I was kind of like, yeah, you know, this piano vibe's not a bad idea. And then, you flew over because we had a Grammy brunch gig, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right. That's what we used as leverage for. We got me over there and then thought, great.
I remember I was very jealous.
Well, don't be.
I mean, the gig was, I mean, blessed. It was fun. But out of the King Size, we also got 2 days later, the beginnings of 2 days later, which actually, talk about us being ethical and recycling, the sessions we got for 2 days later from the Lap Steel and the Fender Rhodes, made it onto the finished Hard Believer. So
that's right. Yeah,
never let it be said that we waste anything. And I think we got the beginnings of the Green and the Blue as well, I think.
Yeah, we did a lot of jamming because we were like, look, man, we should explore this jamming riffs idea. You know, we jammed, yeah, you know, hundreds of jam sessions for this. Yeah, after King Size, we jammed in Electric Monkey, a bunch of stuff. We jammed our friends the Boxer Rebellion had that big tour, and they were like, you can use our dungeon in King
Dungeon in
that's in right.
London.
I forgot that.
Where was that? It was in Hackney, right?
Yeah, it was.
It was Old Street. Yeah, just it was Fortress. I don't think
Fortress
is a sort of like, you know, multi-studio complex, and they were in the basement.
They had like basement for real, as in no windows. If you've got any sense of claustrophobia or fire exit problems, then it was not a good place to be.
And no fresh air. I remember being down there for about 6 hours once and having to leave because I felt sick because I'd like run out of oxygen. So I remember particularly just going back to Electric Monkey, I remember particularly White Flag being born there. And again, I think we used some of that was Guy's tune. So we jammed it for like 15 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But used the same homemade plate reverb that Casper had done.
Yeah, we tried to top it in the studio with Billy, but at the end of the day, it was just quicker and easier to use one of these session parts that was like, man, this sounds great, let's just use this. And
yeah.
You know, White Flag, after Guy brought it to the table and everything, and we did this mega White Flag jam in Electric Monkey, which was loads of fun. I did write a song on it. But I just couldn't get the song to the finish line properly. And the end result of that was we recorded it fully with words and songs and everything. But at the end of the day, I took it home and muted everything and turned it into more of an instrumental kind of moment.
Yeah. I was skipping forward a bit, but did you actually record the song in Sound Factory with Billy? Did it get that far?
I have a board mix of it with the full lyrics on it. Yeah.
And Guy, did you write some of those lyrics? Or I think,
well, yeah, Finn. I remember Finn persuaded me that we should try to do it together. So I remember spending a day of trying to write lyrics, and that was a real eye opener for me because I remember being told by yourself, Finn, that lyric writing can be the heaviest lift of anything.
Yeah, for sure.
And boy, were you right. My goodness, it's hard, isn't it? we were writing all day. And, you know, you come up with, like you say, you can write a whole side of A4. And if you come up with, you know, two or three sentences or two or three phrases that you're happy with, that's a win. We did. Some of the lyrics we wrote were good. But like you say, mate, they just wouldn't quite jimmy themselves into the song somehow.
Yeah, I mean, Hard Believer, like a track like Shakespeare was a concept I've been wanting to write for ages, which was, why do they teach you Shakespeare at school when you haven't got the emotional range to understand the bandwidth of what's being talked about?
Yeah.
And the only person in the room is the teacher, is the teacher who gets why you're so in love with someone you're willing to kill yourself for them. And you don't know that at 15. Well, maybe you do, but I didn't. So and it was the same with White Flag. I had this concept, which was like, you have this flag and then all the colors can get bleached out and every flag is white underneath, kind of thing. And I really wanted, and I thought, oh, that's a great idea for a song. Oh, that's going to be brilliant. But I just couldn't step up to it. And all the lyrics I wrote, they just didn't do the business. But then we'd listened to a few albums leading up to the recording of Hard Believer from bands that we loved, like Arcade Fire. And
yeah, that was the year Reflector came out.
Exactly.
And that was Reflector, a huge influence on this.
On Reflector, there were some instrumentals as well. So we were kind of like, okay, look, there's nothing wrong with putting instrumentals on an indie album. In a way, it was almost like that was a problem, and then all of a sudden, because of great bands like Arcade Fire, it was okay not to again. So, and same with Tom York. I think he just put out Eraser, because I think I went to Amoeba and I bought Eraser, Reflector, and The Knife. I think I bought The Knife at the same time. It was a really good year, and Amoeba is obviously a great place to wander about and record shop. So. Yeah. So it became instrumental. But yeah, the genesis of the tracks was definitely born from us jamming in studios, which again enabled us to feel kind of like a proper band. This is what proper bands do, isn't it? All the photos you have of the bands you love, that they're always in some studio kind of being like, oi, Keith, can you play this riff better? Or oi, Mick, can you sing like this thing? And you just kind of go, that's us now.
Yeah.
Look at us, you know.
And there's another.
Can you check me on this?
There's another cog in this whole thing, which is Blair.
Blair McKeon, yeah, he raises because you had a, like a phoenix.
You had a good, I think that was the first time me and Guy came along to a Blair session as well.
Well, Blair McKeon, let me introduce him to everybody again. He's a professional co-writer with a rock palace in Hastings, and he's living and breathing music writing machine. And I'd gone down, I'd written sort of Revolution with him, I'd written This Is The Thing with him, and I said to you guys, listen, this guy Blair, he's like a riff onslaught. It's like a wild stallion. You've just got to, you know, just hang on, basically, you know.
Yeah.
And so we'll go down to Blair's house. And Blair was totally up for it. He's like, yeah, mate, band, awesome. Get him in. Yeah, we'll get wasted. Woo. And like, we'll go down to Blair's house and we'll just basically harness his riff organs all day, all night for 2 days. We'll just jam and jam and jam. And we came out of that 2 day Hastings retreat with 14 songs.
Oh my God.
I've still got them on a drive. It's literally like the Blair sessions with have a jam, have a coffee. Have another jam, a coffee. Oh, guys, what about this? Oh, it's amazing. Have a jam, have a coffee. And 2 days later, we had literally 14 instrumentals.
Yeah.
Some of which I'm still trying to write on even today.
I think we managed to stretch over a couple of albums as well, I think.
I think we did, but don't tell Blair.
No. But the only one I think that made it onto Hard Believer was Pilgrim, which funnily enough was when I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I'd left early, I think.
That's when the magic happens, absolutely. Pilgrim, because if Pilgrim is a massive chord-hungry sort of, vortex, like a massive spiral of chords, and not something a guitarist would necessarily, certainly someone of my limited ability would write, but when you're on piano, you know, you're really free to like wander about and move around. And yeah, that's a Blair classic turn. And I was singing sort of blah, 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 do, do, do sort of lyrics. And then when I took it home, I then filled in the gaps. I didn't change any melodies. My jam was like great. I just wanted to fill I colored it in basically. And yeah, I mean, Pilgrim. And then Pilgrim's a great example of a track which isn't finished until the last day in the studio, like the last minute of the last day. That's when it came together, you know.
I remember we knew that there was something amazing in there, and we couldn't get it at demo level. It was always a bit kind of sort of trying too hard in a way. We thought, let's put strings on it, and you know, that would make it sound sort of stately and interesting. But it just what it needed in the end, which is what we got in the studio, as you say, was a bit of aggression. Was a bit of menace.
Just a dynamic.
Yeah.
I mean, you needed to be, but you were smashing that drum kit so hard by the end,
sure.
Giving the drummer from Faith No More a run from his money, which frankly, in a lot of other circumstances, just you wouldn't be inclined to smash it that hard.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you just plain wouldn't.
But even before that, Guy, when we first, the three of us first jammed it on acoustic guitars in, there was kind of aggression, well, not aggression, energy.
Yeah, just energy.
There.
Yeah, for a front footed.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, front footed lean. Yeah. Exactly. It's definitely driving forward.
But that,
yeah,
but that, sure. As you know, as you say, wouldn't necessarily have come anywhere but the sort of inspirational studio we were in eventually. So
Talking of which, I mean, I don't think any of us had any. We always had our sights set on going back to LA after recording Perfect Darkness, because we were like, that experience was awesome. And
yes,
you know, we only had 14 days with Billy Bush to get to know him and record and mix an entire record. So we all felt like, oh man, you know, Billy, we just scratched the surface with this sonic genius.
Yeah.
It'd be great to go back. And again, he was gracious enough to give us the kind of discount that allows that to happen. And so we kind of knew what we were going back into, so we could like prepare for it, like, oh man, you know, get everything ready and just be like, oh, Billy's going to smash this one. And that's going to sound amazing. And
can you remember why he decided to go to Sound Factory instead of Steakhouse? Because I don't think I can.
I think it was the demos were different and he needed a different sound.
Okay.
And I think Steakhouse was a kind of acoustic-y, wooden-y, real-worldy type situation. And Sound Factory was much more kind of band roll-in, band set-up, band bang-it-out type scenario.
Yeah.
Which I think we needed for this record.
Yeah.
It was a lot more alt indie than alt folk.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So it's like, okay, we need like an indie studio. And Sound Factory was perfect because, like you say in the book, Timmy, Steakhouse was a little bit off the beaten track, but Sound Factory was like, yeah, you're walking down the walk of fame, and you turn left and you're in Sound Factory.
Yes,
so it's like,
exactly,
you're literally, I mean, it's so amazing to walk. And we didn't stay in Coakwood apartments.
Yeah.
We stayed in an Airbnb, so we felt really kind of like, you know, embedded.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just so awesome. And Amoeba was right around the corner as well.
It was, yeah. So there was all sorts of things there, you know. It was, and we could, I mean, I know this sounds a bit kind of juvenile, but we saw the Hollywood sign each morning on our way in.
Yeah, no, we totally did. Like, and that means something. Yeah. It really does. Yeah, no, totally. So, yeah, I think that's why he chose Sound Factory.
Right. So we thought, okay, let's go to LA. Let's do it again. So we had that time then up until, I think, October, to finish all the songs and arrive with sort of enough. So at some point during that, Looking Too Closely emerged.
Yes, which emerged. I thought that it emerged kind of fully formed, you know, like Buddha himself being able to walk and talk and all that kind of stuff. But actually, I found an old demo the other day where it's at a different tempo, different time signature, all in bits.
Right.
And Looking Too Closely, the chorus was the verse, and it was all a bit different. But that one went through many genesis to get to the finish line. And I, again, with us, I remember the demo being firing. And so it was like Looking Too Closely. What didn't have any particular shine on it more than any other track at this point. It was just one of nine, you know. But
But
the demo was really good, and it ticked all these boxes, all these industry boxes. Like, it's up-tempo, it's catchy, all this stuff, which is all the reasons why I was a little bit, you know, afraid of it, because it was very commercial, even though I'd bloody written it and I'm gonna have to bloody sing it. You know, I did feel like, yeah, okay, this is quite commercial, and how do I feel about that? And yeah, and that changed day by
day. You felt that early
on? Yeah, because it's got a really simple chorus, and it's got a repeat chorus, and it's got these really simple verses with repeat hooks at the end of them. And it's not like Green and the Blue, which is a really, which I was listening to in the car on the way in today, do this podcast, which is a remarkably well-written song, beautifully crafted, amazing, deep lyrics, a fantastic, like, storyline about, you know, oh God, it's so clever and intricate. And then Looking Too Closely, which is like, let's just say it's not as complicated, which is why, what made it so successful, right? It's more of a great song written simply.
Yeah.
About simple emotions that are complicated. And yeah, and so, yeah, I had a tricky relationship with that one, and still do, I think, to this day, even though it's like every time I go to approach it, even today as an acoustic version for a radio session or something, I'm still going to go, okay, I need to find a way in. It's not like other songs of ours where I play a chord and I'm in. Looking Too Closely sometimes still requires for me to go, dude, get over yourself, man. It's a great song. Just do it justice. Love it and get into it, you know?
But I mean, I think we both, I mean, Guy, you said that you knew it was a big song as soon as you heard it, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also, just purely selfishly, I just loved playing it immediately.
Yeah.
You know, and like sometimes things are, you know, not that straightforward. It takes more of a wrangle. But, it, you know, rare occasions when I just instinctively feel I know what is going to be the right thing, and both you guys instantly agree. Like, literally just two thumbs up from everybody. This is absolutely spot on. But yeah, I mean, Looking Too Closely was a game changer, and the argument that followed from it, you know, definitely threw up interesting band dynamics. But if I can just detour for a minute, the track that best sums up where we were for me on that record personally is actually the title track itself.
Oh, and yeah.
The reason why that is that, notable from their absence in this conversation so far, is there is another group of people with a lot of input into this, and that's Ninja, of course.
Sure.
Who, after Perfect Darkness, probably had a slightly different perspective on us. We had a slightly different perspective on us. I'm sure they did. So I remember sitting there having a coffee with our long-suffering A&R dude, Skev, who, you know, we all know and love, a magnificent bloke. And his one instruction was, absolutely no blues allowed. And where other bands would take that advice as an actual rule and follow it, We went home, and I believe that very day, carried on working on an 8-minute blues track that became the title track and the album opener. So I think we had a little arrogance, you know, that we hadn't had before as well.
I don't know, we could do our own thing. I think that arrogance is way too strong a word for it. I think that Skev, you know, he lived in Brighton, I lived in Brighton, we were kind of good mates, and he could just see me arcing into blues quite heavily and just personally. And he was just like, dude, he was just scared that I was going to write a blues album.
I see.
Subsequently, I bloody well did. But he was just scared that the follow-up to Perfect Darkness was going to be a blues concept album. And he was just like, Fink doesn't need this right now.
Right,
you
know, okay.
What you need is a big, bashy, alt-indie album, which is why he was like, add hand claps or add tambourine.
Yeah.
He's just like, just please don't do a blues concept album. And Hard Believer, yeah, because I wanted to do... It was in me and it was happening and it had to come out. And that's because of Wheels on Perfect Darkness. I did a blues experiment and it wasn't a dodgy pastiche of a genre that I shouldn't record. It turns out, actually, it sounds really good and I owned it in my own way. Yeah. And I'd love to do it again. So, and the voice, even if we are doing a big, bashy, alt-indie album with power ballads and singles and stuff like that, I didn't want to lose sight of the fact that my voice does lend itself to this genre.
Yeah.
So don't ignore it completely, even if the label is like, please don't get too into this. I mean, having said that, we were already way out of Ninja Tune's comfort zone in terms of what our music sounded like.
Yeah.
And yeah, the discussions had already begun to kind of talk about, we can't really release the next record on Ninja Tune because you're just not Ninja Tune anymore. Doesn't mean that we don't have a relationship with them and still do, and it's a beautiful thing, but...
They seem to have abandoned that concern these days. Sorry, just to digress, but they don't worry about that anymore, I've noticed. Like, you know, they release now things...
Well, because we're not on Ninja Tune anymore. Oh, well, I mean, as a label.
Yeah, like Black Country New Road would never have come out on Ninja Tune in 2014. It would have come out on something else. Would have come out on Counter or something.
Yeah, I suppose you're right, man. But I suppose Ninja... labels develop and grow and change just like bands do.
Sure,
and,
of course.
And the labels that don't just get tagged to a genre which comes and goes and then they come and go.
Yeah.
You're getting feedback from a label on your demos, it's the most difficult email to read of all the emails you're going to get because, you send them all your songs that you've poured your heart and soul into and you've got all this baggage on each song that you've built up like a shield and like no one's allowed to say that this chorus is rubbish, it's brilliant and so on. And the label's looking at it from a totally different perspective. They're just like, look, we're just trying to sell records just like you. We're just trying to enable what you want. So here's our opinion. This song isn't very good, and this song is great, and this song's what we need, and this song isn't. And God, the number of times we had that email and were just like, oh no, you know, they don't get it, or they do get it, or they get the wrong one, or stuff like that.
It's so crestfallen, I know. I remember there was one, I mean, we might have to edit this bit out, but I remember there was one occasion where they wrote you an email or left you a voicemail or something saying that they thought your lyrics could do with some improving.
Yeah.
And would you like to work with another lyricist? And then everyone went home for the holidays. And so you were left with this. So you immediately thought, I'm going to reply to this, or I need to ring them up and talk it through. And everyone had gone home. So you had like 2 weeks to stew like about this kind of, you know, piece of criticism.
It's a tough one, man. It's a tough one. Again, and Skev was like, and I was like, dude, I'm totally up for whatever. Let me know who you want me to write with. But, it's a tricky one. And at the end of the day, you know, you should listen to the label. And we always did. It's just you just shouldn't reply to emails straight away because, they're going to be very vitriolic and very like, you don't get it, man. You know, you don't get where I'm at. Oh, God, you know, you don't even like music anymore. And actually, that's just not true. They're just like, dude, just write a better chorus. That's all I'm saying. But, you know, it's very difficult to tell me that.
I think it was up until Hard Believer, Finn, you'd actually shielded, well, certainly me, at least, from these emails. You wouldn't show me the unfiltered email of criticisms of the demos, possibly because you knew I might just get upset. And I remember when you did show me one, it was exactly that, you know, this chorus is weak, this song's rubbish, and me reading it going, oh my God. And you going, dude, I remember you saying, dude, this is the most positive responses we've ever had. You should have seen the email for biscuits for breakfast. You'd have cried. You'd have cried for a month. And I remember thinking like, wow, I'm so shielded from all this.
That's true. No, it's true, man, because, you know, everyone has their inner circle, right? And you play your demos to your girlfriends or your friends or, you know, your mates and, you know, and you get some honesty through that. Mainly what's good. What are the good bits?
True.
Not really what are the bad bits. And you kind of navigate that by kind of going, right, nobody mentioned this song, which means that's probably not one of the stronger songs or one of the catchier songs, should we say. And, you know, one of the golden rules that I've found recently from producing a bunch of albums, which I've done over lockdown, is that the song that you go, oh, I probably won't make the record, it's a bit too commercial. Yeah, that's the best song you've got. And when you play it to all your mates are going to zero in on that song and go, oh my God, it's amazing. I love this one. You should make this the first single. It's guaranteed it's the one that you think's a bit too obvious, a bit too easy. But there's some kind of universality, isn't there, in obviousness?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some kind of feelings which are obvious, which are universal and also therefore touch people.
Perhaps, you know, Guy said this in the book as well, us being obvious isn't necessarily as obvious as some bands, you know, so we still sound kind of a little bit alternative and spiky, you know, even when we think we're being ultra, ultra commercial.
Absolutely. I was just trying to remember how Billy navigated these conversations, because, you know, as a band, we've demoed all these things in studios. We really fancy ourselves as you know, alt rock stars now. We've toured on a bus and everything. It's official. And then we get label feedback, which is choppy waters, to be fair. And that's fair enough. And then Billy's feedback, do you remember what Billy's was? Or was it just like, dude, just get in there and record it? I can't remember.
Yeah, pretty much. Billy's attitude was, don't worry. Yeah, he's constant. It's just that calmness that he exudes. I remember him, you could ring him up or speak to him in person, going, oh, dude, I'm really freaking out about this. And he would just do that thing of Billy just, you know, it's like a taking 10 deep breaths. He literally just goes, don't stress about it.
But
mate,
I think
just play the tunes.
He would have also been quite happy if we'd gone even more commercial.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember Deep Calm Gate?
No, I don't. I do remember the song, though.
Well, so Deep Calm was a major contender in all this process. We were taking it to LA along with all the other Shakespeare's and Looking Too Closely's. And I guess that we didn't quite know how we wanted to play it. But Billy was just like, just turn this one into a kind of pop rock banger kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, don't worry about it. Don't be self-conscious about it. Just play it.
I was self-conscious about the fact that it's a song called Deep Calm and it was littered with sailing analogies so clumsily that it was kind of like still waters, tides, waves. I mean, I threw fucking everything in there.
Right,
and it was
just,
I think maybe that's why I didn't make the record. Because I was like, dude, I should be smoking a pipe with a parrot on my shoulder when I perform this one.
Your inner Cornish sailor coming out.
I think eventually we gave it to a movie, didn't we? Give it to a movie or something?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, again, it's like, if we knew now what, if we knew then what we knew now, we probably would have gone bigger and more commercial across the board on Hard Believer for sure. Because now, you know, I think we've shed a lot of the bullshit that goes with, you know, trying to work out who you are. I think we've all worked that out. So it would be great to, in a way, that's why this It Isn't Until It Is sort of best of concept thing is really great, because we can reapproach these tracks with none of the baggage that we had when we were recording them.
Sure, exactly. So we were preparing to go to LA. Now there's one other thing that we were also preparing for, and that's the arrival in LA of Ruben Hine. Because we'd been told by you at this point to expect a, as Guy puts it, giant Dutch piano player to arrive.
Exactly. Giant Dutch pianist. So, Ruben Hine was awesome. I met Ruben Hine, I don't even...
Wasn't it at Casper's studio or something?
It was at Casper's studio. He was a session musician on a session I did there. And he was awesome. Amazing piano player, great voice. And I just thought, mate, real kindred spirit. And I thought, wow, this guy's awesome. If I need that. And then we came up with the concept of flying him to LA to do the piano session on Hard Believer, which which was bloody brilliant. And I think we bought an airbed, didn't we, at some store?
We
and
bought an airbed. We did.
We did. I had to scour the apartment for sheets. I remember the morning he was coming, looking around and panicking, going, "Where are we going to put him? There's nowhere for him sleep."
He slept in the living room.
Yeah, we made a little nest for him. It was like a nest.
And I think you did that, Guy.
Yeah, I did. I just clicked into like, you know,
which is ironic considering you were the one who was the least looking forward to his arrival.
Oh, I hated the idea of some talented motherfucker showing up in a fucking studio. But I clicked into like dad mode and just thought this poor jet lagged dude's going to show up and no one's made a comfy bed for him. So I just made this little nest in the corner. he needed it. He needed it. Boy, was that whip was cracking.
It was quite a shock for him because you've just triggered another memory of mine from that Airbnb apartment in LA, which was it had wooden floors. It was one of these really like paper thin, you know, DIY houses that LA's full of. Like it's going to fall down in you just have to blow on it. It's going to fall down.
Yeah.
And I was in the middle of doing this DVD fitness routine at the time called Insanity with Shawnee T. And so every morning I would get up and then I would do this 50 minute jumping up and down, grunting. You know, do you remember me doing that?
Yeah, I definitely do.
Did you punch mattresses?
I used to punch pillows and I used to put the mattress up against my door and punch the mattress and all this health and fit.
It was intense.
Poor Ruben, you know, the first morning he's woken up to, you know, me a couple of meters down the corridor, basically sounding like I'm attacking a gorilla at some point.
Poor Rubes comes straight from the studio, straight from the plane, straight to the studio, and then first thing next morning, insanity.
Come on, y'all, let's go.
Morning, Rubes.
Poor Ruben, man, because he's an amazing pianist and a great singer and songwriter. But you know, he is Dutch level of height. So he's on this plane. Sumit booked the flight for him, and Ruben, to this day, I believe, felt like he was being hazed by this booking, because Sumit booked him a flight on an airline doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, and US Airways.
And it had no entertainment system. And Ruben had to like squeeze in straight into the session and play really basic piano stuff for us. You know, we didn't want anything, because again, we'd been listening to Reflektor and Arcade Fire, and we didn't want Rachmaninoff. We wanted ding 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 ding, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, he was awesome, wasn't he? Bless him. He really stepped up.
He was brilliant. And poor chap, because I do remember any little jazz trills that he would slip in, Billy Bush would just go, nope. You know, he'd get on the control room mic and say, no, Ruben, no, that's
absolutely
going.
To the point where Ruben actually did say, you know, at one point, you flew me all the way out here just to play this.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we were like, we did.
So I could have shown you how to play that over Skype.
for sure. But we did let him off the leash on the Shakespeare a bit.
Yeah, I just love the fact that there's a photo that has featured in a few of our things that looks completely staged of Ruben asleep at the piano, but as we can vouch, he was not faking it. That is a man passed out at a keyboard who's about to get some instructions back through his headphones, which will wake him up to do it again. I've never seen a man work harder, to be honest. I've never seen a man work harder. It was a relentless few days.
And he did get himself onto
every track. I think he was originally on like, I don't know, maybe 50% of them. But by the time we were finished, he was on pretty much everything.
Yeah, I mean, once you get a musician in the room, you might as well go to it. I guess he must have arrived kind of late in the session then, because we must have already tracked a bunch of stuff before he arrived.
I think it was like halfway. He came for like the latter section, I think.
In the book, Timmy, I think you mentioned, or maybe Guy, you mentioned that Looking Too Closely was the first track we laid down in the Hard Believer session.
It was.
And I was just kind of wondering, what was our thought process, just in case other bands managed to ever listen to this? You know, what was our thought process in terms of what running order should we record the songs in?
I think that was Billy's call. I think we often, if my memory is correct, I might be wrong here because my memory is hazy at the best of times. I think that that was a producer's shout. We allowed him, we said, what do you want us to do first? And he said that one. And I think the logic was, it was the most, we know what it's going to be. There's not going to be much changing. If we could just buff all the demo, it would be, there you go, that would be it. So we just need to faithfully try to reproduce what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
I think that was the logic.
That's true.
Personally.
And he did the same thing on Perfect Darkness. He wanted us to start with Yesterday's Hard on All of Us. because it was sort of like, let's get that one down.
Yeah, a solid, reliable start.
Yeah, so we know where we are. And I guess it worked. Other than that, I can't remember what we continued on. Maybe also we were wanting to get the Reuben ones down before Reuben arrived.
That's probably it. Yeah. So then we could get on with it afterwards. That's very true. Because it's always a difficult,
some logic.
It's a difficult question, and it always pops up every session any band will ever do, and that is what should we start with? Yeah. Do we start with the easy one? Do we start with the hard one? Do we start with the single? Do we start with the one that doesn't matter? But the thing is,
it's such a crucial decision.
Well, as Billy Bush taught us and Flood taught us in subsequent albums, you actually don't know what the single's going to be until you've finished the record, because you think it's going to be this one, but I guarantee you, you'll probably cut it and it'll end up being this other one that you didn't have any ambitions for. So, I'd say with the Hard Believer album, we didn't record it thinking that any tracks were going to be focus tracks. We just wanted to give every track the full Monty.
Yeah.
I don't remember thinking, this is a focus track, this is an album track, with the exception of a couple maybe, where we thought, this is a filler. But I also seem to remember something as I was driving in today, that I think I'd just been on holiday in Canada to this really weird cabin in the middle of a reservation, in the middle of nowhere.
Mm.
And in this 90s themed cabin, there was some Nine Inch Nails records and Trent Reznor records on CD.
Right.
And I got into one, and Timmy, you said, oh, that's the one with this running theme that runs through it.
Yeah.
There's this like little theme in it all the time.
That's right, yes. The little melody that keeps appearing.
Yeah, which album is
that's
that?
That's the Downward Spiral.
Downward Spiral. So I got into the Downward Spiral while in this log cabin, and so we did that with Hard Believer.
Yeah.
We put a little do, which is also the theme tune for Thames TV from when we were kids, right?
Maybe it is. Did we think of that before?
It's that.
And now
Rainbow. Yeah,
that's right. Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, we definitely did do that. And one of my kind of conceptual moments during Hard Believer was that I think there was a bit of panic about three quarters of the way through that we literally didn't have enough songs.
Yeah, no.
So
doubt.
we needed to kind of get one
classic. Classic Fink move.
Yeah. And we stayed in the studio listening to some early demos, including, I don't know what it was called, but it was the song that became Truth Begins. So it was quite a kind of up-tempo track at this point, with a sort of very high, you know, almost dancey drum beat. And you were singing essentially the same lyrics as Truth Begins in. And we listened to that the night before and we all thought, yeah, there's something here. We don't know what, but there's something here. And so I remember thinking, what if we tried to jimmy that
do
into it? And I came into the studio early the next morning and just sat with the guitar and thought, how do I put that melody in? And managed to come up with a chord progression. And then you guys came in and I said, so what if we did this and you put the lyrics into it? So we have literally a song that is based around that riff. And then we also heard that riff at the end of Green and the Blue.
Well, exactly. And at the end of the Green and the Blue, I remember that I'd also just discovered the Ebo. And so we took the grand piano and we found a hammer, which we taped the key down with the hammer on it so that it was constant. And then we Ebo'd the piano. I mean, that took fucking ages. And all we got out of it was an ambient outro. And we learned a lesson that day, which was, you know what? We just spent a day Ebo'ing a piano, which was, fun. But Truth Begins is a real sleeper. I wrote that real quick. Mm. It was a real, not disposable emotionally, but just I wrote that as a quick one. But again, like penned from real life, as I say in the book, you know, we'd accumulated a lot of baggage that I didn't necessarily want to have accumulated at that point, and that was a straight up kind of outpouring of like reality baggage type songwriting, and I used to encore with it, I think, on the Hard Believer tour, just jumping forward a little bit, because it really became like
with
the ballad.
Reuben on piano and I played guitar on it, I think.
God, I absolutely love that song. I really
do. Yeah, me too. It's one of my favourites on that album. It's got a real sort of... And also, that was another time in the studio where all three of us were just charging in and putting bits and bobs. Guy played piano on it. we all played percussion on it. We all sang the round and round like the records you. We all sang that together, and so it was a real like that's how to use a studio.
Yeah,
I just feel just thinking about it now, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about that time in the studio because it's the best time, isn't it? When you are really working at the full.
Yeah,
you know,
it's so good, and also
it's so brilliant.
You're working with all your gear, you're loving it, and you're thinking, oh man, this could be, this will be, this is. And then at the end of the session, you walk home via some dodgy, rank Mexican bar and sit outside and drink pints and just think, this is work. We just worked.
Yeah, exactly.
God, it was so good, man. I mean, the studio, that studio, oh yeah, dude, Guy, do you remember when you were stood outside the studio having a joint and then a police helicopter shined a floodlight on you. Do you remember that?
Fucking right, I do.
That was insane.
Yeah, as a pretty stoned Englishman, I wasn't really qualified to know how do you communicate to a hovering police chopper overhead that's going, freeze, buddy, don't move. How do you communicate? I am legitimately in this compound. And what I did was I waved my joint at them and then pointed at the studio and then mimed playing the bass.
Nice.
And they switched the light off and drove away, flew away. Drove away.
Really?
Yeah.
It was so insane.
I remember coming in, I came in a bit traumatized. I thought I was going to get sniped
second. Yeah. Also, because we'd been playing a lot of PlayStation at that point, probably a bit of GTA at that point.
Yeah.
So we were very much in the mix of like, you're lucky you escaped with your life there, bro, type vibe.
Yeah, man. Get away from the chopper.
But yeah, every day in Sound Factory was blurry. But constant, all of us thinking 100% all the time, how can we make this better? And, you know, a lot of, is this cool? Is this not cool? Is this us? Is this not us? But not too much. Just, okay, how can we improve this?
Yeah.
This is big. How can we make it bigger? This is small. How can we make it more intimate? Just every thought in every direction. It was just exhausting, but wonderful, wasn't
it?
Yeah, it really was.
And I'm just thinking of, Shakespeare, that was another one. I mean, that was Ruben's kind of... highlight of like going for it in the piano. But then we also thought we need and this is what's so brilliant about LA, we need something else, we need some other noises in this. And Billy said, well, I've got a friend called Zach Ray who is a master of the Moog. He was playing a Moog, wasn't he?
He's got a bunch of vintage instruments and a majestic beard, and so obviously we were all sold immediately. And the budget was like, he's this much per track, and all I've got to do is just throw him the track, and he'll just throw back, you know, a session on like the Moog, the Jupiter, the Juno, the Whirly, like everything. He's got everything, and we were lucky because he totally got it. He totally got what we needed, and also Billy, in Billy's capable hands as a producer, he could sift through the returns and be like, yeah, we need the Moog, but we don't need that synth. Yeah, we need that synth, but we don't need that arpeggio, just to go through them real quick. And I remember I actually ended up, after we left Sound Factory, you know, and came home and, you know, just got our shit together like that. I remember I had to fly back out to mix it down with Billy. There were a few issues.
You did,
I don't
that's
remember
right.
what they were, but I flew back out to mix it down in Billy's own little studio.
Was that always the plan, or was that... did that come about because you just felt that there was something that needed to be?
Yeah, because, you know, sometimes if you're trying to communicate over emails and Skype calls and phone calls, like Guy said, it's just quicker to be in the room. And Billy goes, what about this? And you go, no, what about this? Yeah. And that might have taken, with the time delay, with the LA thing and the life, our lives, you know, it might have just taken a week to get there. Whereas if you just fly me there, we can just go through all this stuff like real quick.
Yeah.
And I don't remember much about that, but I was there for sort of 3 days or 4 days or something. And the mixdown was just quickly going through the yeses and nos. In person. I think we maybe did some overdubs. I can't remember. Maybe did a couple of guitar dubs there. Not sure. But
and so was it at that point that the looking too closely sort of concerns began to rear their heads?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the title of this chapter, if you don't put this track on the record, I quit. That's a direct quote from Sumit, the manager, after a massive long argument, of which we've had millions over the years, whether it goes to like, you know, set running order to what shoes are you, you're not going to wear those shoes again, are you, type. I mean, literally to like, you know, me and Sumit have argued about everything in every way forever. But this one was a big one because Sumit was like, I was like, listen, man, the mixes have come out and I think I'm going to cut this track Looking Too Closely from the record because it's a bit too commercial. And it's sitting next to White Flag and Pilgrim and Hard Believer, and it just stuck out a little bit for me. And he was just kind of like, you're just crazy. This is a big single, and it could be a life changing moment. And you know, why are we doing this if you're not interested in becoming bigger than you are already? Which, by the way, isn't that big.
Yeah.
You know, you might be flushed with the euphoria of, my rent is covered for a year, but there's always next year.
Yeah.
And it was a real fight. It was a proper fight. I mean, for Sumit to threaten to quit was such a big moment.
I've known
Sumit since he was 20. So,
sure.
You know, it was just a big one.
It definitely takes it from the this is a trivial argument to, you know, this is he really means this for some reason, eh?
Look, man, when you work with your friends, which we all do, everything is personal.
Yeah.
So even what you do for a living becomes personal when you work with your friends. And so for a friend to put that down, as in, the only way to make you listen to me is to you know, throw this card on the table, then because you're not listening to me. And you know, and which led to me to have a bit of an existential discussion with myself, which was, you know, what's wrong with success? What's your problem with this? And it led to me to have that conversation with myself of like, there are many albums that I've got where there's a few tracks on it that I don't like, and one of them might be one of the singles. Doesn't matter. Doesn't mean you don't like the band. Doesn't mean that the band have let you down. And there's lots of albums that I've got where the singles introduce me to the band. And so it's like, you know, that's the thing with a big single. If this does turn out to be a big single for you guys, which he thought it would be, your music's going to touch so many more people. Isn't that what you want? You know? And I guess ultimately I was kind of like, yeah. But you can tell I was still reticent because Looking Too Closely isn't track one or track two. It's track eight.
Well, yeah. You know? I was going to say that was almost like the compromise, because I think what we wanted was an album that was perfect in its running order. We didn't want anything kind of, you know, jarring just for the sake of having the big single up front. So we thought the first
attention grabbing.
Yeah, exactly. So we thought the first four tracks, Hard Believer, Green and Blue, White Flag and Pilgrim, were absolutely fucking smashing it, like in terms of listening to an album. So I think the compromise was, let's not meddle with that. Let's put Looking Too Closely in a nice spot at the very end, not the very end, but the second half of the album, and let it do its thing with another track that was relatively commercial, which was Too Late.
Yeah, so, which honestly, to this day, I always thought Too Late was going to be I thought that was the single, the big single, the life-changing moment.
Yeah.
I thought Too Late was the one that was going to change everything. And it turned out to just end up being a really great album track.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
It's funny, isn't
it? That was the compromise. But I remember there was a bit of a, you know, there was this kind of couple of days of panic of like, I took the view, and I didn't write about this in the book, I'm not quite sure why, but I took the view that this song's got to be on the record, so let's get it into a state that Finn is happy with. Because he's obviously, so let's, even if we take the drums off and it appears as like an acoustic version of that track, let's get it on there somehow. So we were kind of umming and ahhing, and I remember walking around Stoke Newington listening to different versions from Billy.
Right.
Going, is this one good? Is this one going to be good? And we did various things. I think we kind of cut all the guitars in the second half of the song and made it into a kind of weird thing.
Yeah,
you know?
God, I remember that now. There was a, I think maybe you said to me, listen, I'm just going to try a few things with Billy. I hope you don't mind. We're going to like try everything.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the very end, I remember checking my emails and just seeing an email from you going, okay, guys, let's just have the song on the record as it is, please. You know, and it was like, that's the end. That's the end of the discussion. It's back.
Yeah.
I've been convinced.
Yeah, I think, Finn, you rang me last. I remember you ringing me up and you said, look, I've got to ask you a question, and I've already got my answer from Sumit and I've already got my answer from Tim. What do you think about cutting it? And I think I just joined straight in with Sumit. I didn't say I'd quit. I just went, you're fucking nuts, mate.
Yeah, it's no, totally.
It's a brilliant tune. It's a brilliant tune. It's got to stay on.
I remember that because I also think at the time I would have thought, you know, Guy is even less, he's even more allergic to commercial than I am. So True. If there's anyone that's going to be like, yeah, dude, totally, man, God, it's totally selling out. Oh my God, I can't, I'm never going to play that live. I'd be so embarrassed. It would be you. And you were like, dude, it's awesome. You're crazy. It's great. You should put it on. Yeah. And that was kind of like, okay, so it's literally like one of those moments in life where you're like, okay, everybody else has a different opinion to me. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe.
That's exactly what you said to me. You said, you know, if you say that and everybody else says that, then maybe it's me. And you know, man, we've been mates long enough. I didn't mince my words. I said, love you, brother. It is you. You're going to have to just roll with it, I'm afraid.
It's me. I got no timing.
So yeah, we finished recording, we finished mixing, and then begins the great, you know, heading into the how is this going to come out? What's it going to look like? What's the cover going to look like? What's the first single going to be? And all that sort of malarkey. Videos.
Absolutely. This taps into the we're going to do everything differently conversation, which happened at the beginning of Perfect Darkness.
Yeah.
And so on this one, it was like, we're still going to continue to do everything differently in a good way. And you're going to do a video for Looking Too Closely. And it's going to be a performance video. It's not going to be some arty bollocks. It's going to be you guys on a roof playing with a drone. And it's like, okay,
with a drone.
Okay,
yeah.
we can do that. And I'd relinquished all of my, oh, dude, it's not cool enough. I'm now into kind of, dude, whatever it takes, let's just make this record as big as we can. So fine, I'll double denim and I'll mime my song on a rooftop. Fine, we'll do it. Let's go full U2. Let's go full Streets Have No Name on this one.
Yeah. It's not as easy as it looks either.
Definitely not with a drone in your face, which literally looks like it's going to take your head off. And if the guy sneezed, you just lost your lead singer. So... and that was the joy of Berlin back then. You could get a license to fly a drone in a public area. Awesome, not anymore. So, yeah, it was like, you know, the record's going to come out, the reviews are going to be reviewed, and you know, it's going to have some artwork and all that kind of stuff. But the main thing that was on our minds, I think, was the tour.
Right.
You know, tours are promos for albums, albums are promos for tours. Nothing worked at that stage like a radio single and a tour. Those are the two things that are going to move all your needles. So tour, you know, let's presume we're not going to have a radio single. How are we going to tour this? And the tour started to come into focus, and we were all starting to ready ourselves for the biggest tour of all.
Yeah, exactly. I know. And we also decided pretty early on that we wanted to definitely have at least an extra guitarist.
Yeah.
Because there was just too much of me on the record. It was unavoidable. I could not loop station my way out of that.
No, I mean there was also the fact that we had a little bit of bandwidth on the budget because the venues were getting a bit bigger. And so the old adage in the old music industry is that you should add dancers before you add musicians because people like to look at people dancing. But it's like, you know, you were playing so much electric guitar on the record that we'd gone so alt indie that it's like, okay, we need a second guitarist for sure to be the electric guitarist. So Timmy can concentrate on being Timmy, basically, and not just an electric guitarist. And we thought, well, Ruben was game for it. So maybe he'd be game to jump on and rock and roll. So, we need monitors properly now. So we started to put our tour life together, which was very, very exciting. But most importantly, we kind of didn't know what people were going to think of the record because it was a bit of a leap from the early years, especially if you listen to any of the first three albums, to Hard Believer. It is kind of like, wow, who are these guys? So
which is one of the reasons why Ninja said, why don't you put this out on your own label?
Yeah, absolutely. Ninja were very much like, listen, I love Ninja, they love me. I've had the same CEO since 1997. You know, it's literally like I'm family to Ninja and they're family to me. So we were like, look, the only way for us to continue working together, which we would love to, is if we do like a label deal. So
yeah,
then you don't have to worry about Skev going, it needs more hi-hats, and you being like, oh, Skev, God, you're deaf, how could you think that, oh, you're mad, you know, and we can just make those bad decisions ourselves. So Recoup Records was born, which is a beautiful thing.
And that's its first release, wasn't it? Hard Believer is RCP-001.
Yeah, it's the first release. Actually, I think technically the very first release on Recouped was the 7-inch single that we issued for the launch night at the Albert Hall.
Oh, right. And what was on that? I remember that.
It was a version of Shakespeare, I think, and some other version of something else. I never got one. I don't know what it is, but yeah.
I remember that was the deal. If you went along to the Elgar Rooms gig, you got that free.
Free 7, single. Baby.
Fuck, did I completely you? Forgotten about that. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I ever knew about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I remember that. My
don't
God.
Worry, dude. It's been coming out of your Recouped account for years, mate, printing up 500 sevens. Do you know what I mean? It was just a loss. Loss,
so,
bro.
Yeah, I remember that. And that was one of the first gigs with the full 5 lineup. So we ought to introduce Chris Nichols at this point, who was an old...
Nicky Nax.
By this point, a regular mucker of ours. He roadied for us when we played at the Stones gig the previous year.
We actually first met Chris Nichols. He was dating our merchandising ninja, Sean. Who was so much more than that. A drum tech, ninja, everything. She's great. Yeah. But she was dating this guy called Chris, and he came to a gig we played in Manchester.
The Deaf Institute.
The Deaf Institute. And I remember because he was wearing a vest. I know. It's fucking weird what you remember, right? But I remember. And, you know, Chris is a good looking guy, and he had a decent figure at that stage.
Does he not anymore? You know,
at that stage. Yeah, now he's now he looks like Jabba the Hutt.
So, and so there he was. And you know, Sean's really cool, and you know, Sean's just really cool and stylish. And of course, you imagine Sean's boyfriend to be like really cool, you know, ripped, handsome guy. Yeah, it turns out he is, but he is wearing a vest. So, and I clocked that, and that really confused me, and still does to this day. I don't know why. So we actually met Chris that night.
Yeah, that's true. And he's a bass player, by trade, and a very good one.
So I was really. I was really threatened, obviously, by his arrival.
Yeah. I remember going to see a gig in Islington with Natalie McCool, who's a singer-songwriter from Liverpool, and she had Sean on drums, and she had Chris on bass, and Chris looked really cool on stage.
No doubt.
It was a good gig. Natalie was very good, but he just looked awesome, and he turned around effortlessly at one point and played a bit of keys, and then he turned back around again and carried on playing the bass. So I thought, okay, he knows what he's doing. So I remember asking him at one point, can you play any guitar? And he said, yeah, I can play guitar. So we met him, you and I and Chris met in the premises rehearsal rooms in Shoreditch, and just went through our set, and he just played essentially all my guitar parts from the...
Yeah, like literally without hardly any... like. Because he can read music, write music, and knows about music, he literally got all your parts landed in about 10 minutes. There you go. Is that all you need? It's like,
And it really was. You know, then we just said, see you in Greece.
Yeah, see you in Greece.
Which is his first gig.
What, Athens?
Yeah, Plisken.
Was it Plisken? Oh, Athens. God, I remember that. I remember Plisken because... it was us looking exhausted, our sound guy asleep at backstage, and then this ruggedly handsome, ripped young man called Chris, who was getting all the female attention at our show. Do you remember?
All the girls were like,
"Who's that guy? Yeah. He's really hot." And we got some free sunglasses, which I've still got to this day. That gig.
Oh yeah.
I was so pleased. It finally took the heat off me with the good look front.
Exactly.
The thing about that gig for Chris was, talk about a trial by fire. So first gig with us, he had no monitoring whatsoever. He had a wedge that didn't work, and we had no in ears. So ask Chris one day; he'll tell you all about how he played their first gig with us in total silence, as far as his own instrument. Ridiculous.
No, it was a Plisken festival. Was great. I remember that. Apart from the fact that I got free Ray-Bans, but I also met a really lovely friend of mine called Deadbeat, and who's been my friend ever since at that show. But we supported. Well, we were on the same bill as some amazing bands.
It was really good, actually.
Wild Beasts.
Wild Beasts, that's
Wild
right.
Wild Beasts, yeah. I think, wasn't it?
Wild Beasts, Crystal Castles, Soons, I saw for the first time there.
Who were amazing.
Oh, they were amazing. Soons were amazing.
They were.
I've subsequently... I'm quite good mates with the guys from Soons now, but subsequently seen them a ton of times, and they're just such an incredible band.
And Fuck Buttons, who were just the most loud, horrible electronic band you've ever heard.
Yeah, like
amazing,
synth punk.
But...
like, dude, you're going to leave this show being, even questioning what music actually is. Kind of like the Swans. When you see Swans live, you're like, did I just experience a concert or some kind of cult event? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But
true.
Yeah, Pliskin, that was awesome. So, but I think we're going to probably cover the Hard Believer tour in its entirety in the next podcast, aren't we?
In the next podcast, episode 8.
We're gonna
go into the touring and all of that side of things because it's so epic. It deserves its own episode.
It does.
It's episode 8, the final. The finality. This is the.
Well, I think we might do another one.
Yes.
We talked yesterday about maybe doing all the touring in number 8 and then doing an episode 9, which is the conclusion. What have we learned?
Yes.
From. Ah. 10 years and what had we learned?
What had we learned? Yeah, exactly.
What did we do in our holidays? Okay, love it.
Yes.
Watch TV.
So, yeah,
sounds great.
Click us in the next episode.
Absolutely. And thanks for joining us again on our little wander down memory lane.
Absolutely. See you next time.
It's good times.